Welcome to Gambling with an Edge with your hosts, Bob Dancer and Richard Munchkin. Bob Dancer is America's premier video poker writer and teacher. He's written 10 books, including Video Poker for the Intelligent Beginner and the best-selling Million Dollar Video Poker. He helped develop the computer software Video Poker for Winners, and in 2004, he was inducted into the Video Poker Hall of Fame. Richard Munchkin has been a professional Advantage player for over 30 years and is in the Blackjack Hall of Fame. His book, Gambling Wizards, Conversations with the World's Greatest Gamblers, is a testament to the many ways you can succeed at gambling. The goal of the show is that you'll be a more knowledgeable gambler tomorrow than you were yesterday. And now, here are Bob and Richard.
Good evening. Welcome to Gambling with an Edge. I'm Bob Dancer. Hello, Richard. How are you tonight?
Good, good. Things are going well.
Tonight, our guest is going to be Professor I. Nelson Rose, who is an expert on gambling and the law. So we're going to be asking him about Full Tilt and some Indian casinos and inter and intranet gambling. And that's going to be what we're talking about tonight. But before we get there, a student of mine at a class semester I just finished at South Point was thinking about considering himself a professional gambler rather than a recreational gambler. And so he wanted to know what he should think about or what questions he should ask himself before he knew whether he was going to be a professional gambler or a recreational gambler. My first question to him is, why do you care? Are you trying to impress your mom or somebody else? Do you think it's easier to get laid if you are a professional gambler? My personal experience is that isn't the case, but
definitely.
Your mileage may vary. We might talk about that later. But there are tax differences between filing as a professional gambler and not doing so. There are some self-employment taxes and the ability to deduct losses and several other things that change when your tax status changes. Neither Richard nor I are tax advisors, and so talk to your accountant, but that's definitely part of the equation. There are differences there that are not minor. Another thing, to me, that seems like
the only issue that's really important. You know, the rest of it is, you know, whatever you're comfortable telling people or not, or do you actually make your living doing it? Those are personal issues that aren't really the tax considerations are, you know, important, you know, and need to be weighed. But
thanks a lot, Richard. You're saying the only important thing is the part we're not talking about. Okay, going on. One of the things to consider is: are you a winning player? You know, are you making money gambling?
Yeah. To me, a professional is someone who makes the majority of their income at gambling. I mean, that's what a professional means, right?
Well, at least a significant part. I consider myself a professional at several things, including gambling and including writing and various other things. And obviously, I can't make my majority of income at all of them, but a major part. And although I do remember back when I was playing blackjack in the early 90s, there was this guy who came up to me and said that if he could get his losses down to $1,000 a month, he's thinking of turning pro. At the time, I thought that was hilarious. But he would say that out loud in front of the pit critters, and hopefully, I think it was to deflect suspicion. I don't know if it deflected or...
That's a great line in any case.
All right. So, do you care what other people think? A lot of people believe that professional gamblers have gambling addiction problems, and some do. And convincing somebody you don't is an impossible task. I still get asked, how come I'm addicted to gambling? And I've been doing this for a number of years, and nobody who knows me considers me an addict, but I still get those questions.
You know, this was certainly a big problem for me when I was single. Uh-huh. you know, I would meet women, and yeah, they would think, you know, I mean, they would say, like, isn't this like you're an alcoholic? Eventually, you're just going to lose all your money. And I was like, no, this is more like I own a brewery. For every bottle that goes down the conveyor belt, I make a profit. And, you know, I want more bottles per hour to go down that conveyor belt. But it was very, a lot of people just don't understand that it is possible to win consistently, to be a professional gambler.
Right. They believe the casino always wins. And
yeah.
Good. And another thing I think you consider is, what if things go bad and you lose all your money and you have to go out and get a job? Now, and you list on your resume that between 2012 and 2014, you were a professional gambler. This could be a problem at some jobs.
Yeah. You know, and I think it depends a lot where you live. I remember when I first moved to Las Vegas,
uh-huh.
I went and bought a car, and they were trying to sell me a car. I said, well, I don't have enough for that car. And the guy said, well, we'll give you a loan. And I said, you're not going to give me a loan. I'm a professional backgammon player. And the guy said, can you prove it? And I said, well, yeah. And sure enough, they gave me a loan and listed my occupation as professional backgammon player. But in California, I think the reaction would be a lot different than it would be in Vegas.
Well, in Vegas, if a lot of employers would think, well, if this guy gets his stake again, he's going to go back to gambling. And so he's probably not going to...
Oh, yeah, yeah. Certainly in terms of going out working in the straight world, yes, I agree. But even socially, like... Living in California when my kids were little and first went to school, I mean, none of my neighbors knew what I, even today, none of my neighbors know what I do for a living. They don't, you know, when I'm talking to the soccer moms or whatever, you know, people think I'm a writer. I just thought, you know, where I live, it may be a problem for my kids, you know, so I didn't want to have them affected by it. Whereas in Las Vegas, if you tell your neighbors you're a professional gambler, it's ho-hum, you know?
Yeah, oh, it's like, oh, good, can you get me show tickets to
right.
I don't hide very well that I'm a professional gambler. I pass out flyers to here come to my classes, and, you know, it has my picture on it and stuff, and so...
But still, people still ask me about you, Bob, if you still play video poker. They think of you more as, you know, a writer and a radio host. They don't realize you're actually out there in the trenches.
Probably an average of 20 to 25 hours a week. Some weeks it's 80 hours, and occasionally a few weeks I'm just out there picking up free play. But, yeah, it's an average of 20, 30 hours a week for me. Let's change subjects. We talked about casino drawings a month or two ago, and they are a significant part of making it as a winning video poker player in Las Vegas today. Some people can do it without the drawings. I can't. My personal expectation in drawings is around $80,000 a year from the drawings, the Friday and Saturday night drawings, occasionally on other days.
That's pretty good.
Well, and they're the dish. This year, fortunately, we got a car for Shirley and a drawing, which was not expected. But that makes it easier to get to $80,000 if you get $28,000 all at once. In many years, they've been the difference between having a winning year and losing year. I've since '94, I've had one losing year gambling, but if you took out drawings. You know, in things like slot tournaments, I would have probably had five or six losing years gambling. That said, drawings are a nuisance to go to. You have to be there at the right time, usually. You have to deal with the parking and the crowds, and usually you don't win. There, for drawings where they have 10 winners, they will have 500 people there and hoping to be called, and 490 of them will go home. Damn, should have stayed home. So the usual number is, usual thing is you're not going to win. And the drawings waste about an hour each, ballpark, between driving there, parking, standing around. And if you win collecting, although I don't mind that part of it a whole lot. But there are people who show up for drawings when they have very little chance of winning. To me, this is a huge waste of time. It used to be the Palms would give you one drawing ticket per day just by swiping your card. And this couple would come in and swipe their cards for both of them. And they lived like 15 miles away. So when they'd get there to the Friday night drawings, they would have seven tickets because they swiped their card for one drawing. I would have 5,000 tickets or something. And they would have seven because they had made a 15-mile drive every day to swipe both their cards.
I
thought that was not a good use of their time. Now, in my classes, my personal thing is if I don't have an expectation of at least $250 at a drawing, I'm not going to show up. I usually get that by playing more than other players do. And so in a sense, I'm able to use a bankroll and the... it's comfortable for me to play $5 machines and higher, and so I use that as a weapon. And some players can't do that, and I understand they can't do that, and so that gives me an advantage, and I understand that upsets some people that I have that advantage. Trust me, you don't want to be around when I lose $30,000 and have to explain it to Shirley, but be that as it may. About a month ago, I had I won $5,000 at the Gold Coast Pumpkin Patch drawing, actually, 5250. Someone asked me if this meant I would start going to more drawings, because if my own average only expected to be 250 at drawings, then if I won 5,000, then I could coast through 20 drawings. And to me, it was like apples and oranges. The decision I always make is about the next drawing, not the last one.
Right, these are independent trials, so they
are
doing each other.
Yeah, and so the fact that I won a big time at one point doesn't affect that I need an EV of $250 to do the next one. Another thing at Sam's Town on Thursday, sometimes I go for the senior drawings where the maximum you can win is $300. And so people go, if you have to have an EV of 250, how can you show up at a drawing where the maximum you can win is 300 and you don't win all the time, so your EV has to be lower than that? And the answer is true, but there's more to it. They have 5x points on that day, and so if I'm going to have to play for my monthly mailers, I got to do it sometime. So I might as well play on a 5x point day. And so for the day as a whole, it has the right kind of positive EV, but even though for the drawing in and of itself, it doesn't.
Makes sense.
Okay. So, all right. So tell me... I just got passed a note that the number we're supposed to use to call Professor Rose is his fax number rather than his phone number. So, Richard, why don't you talk for a little bit while I look up his phone number? And it's going to take me a little bit. So, Richard, you're on. Speak.
Okay, great. Well, let's see. I guess I'll talk about... next week, we're going to have Max Rubin on. Max is the author of Comp City and a guy who's been around gaming for, 50 years or so. We're going to talk about comps for each different level of players. So if you're a red chip player, where are the places you should be targeting? How are you going to get the best comps? And what kind of comps can you expect as a red chip player? And then we'll also talk about green chip players and what they can expect, and then the higher end black chip players and above. So we really want to try to focus on how you can maximize your comps from the casino. To really, the idea is to get more than what you deserve or more than what they think you deserve, how we can trick them into giving us more. In my own case, I am always playing as a refusal. I don't show them a player's card because if I do get barred in a place, I don't want them knowing a name or anything about me. So if they send a flyer out, it'll just say extremely handsome guy in a baseball hat.
Is this the same guy who hosts a radio show with me? Is this are we talking about the same guy here?
Same guy. But there are other times when I am specifically playing for comps. And those times I'm going in, for example, you know, there's a Pacquiao fight in a few weeks.
Uh-huh.
And those tickets are going to be worth cash. Airfare reimbursements are cash.
Uh-huh.
So if I'm going in to play for comps, then I'm going to play in a way that is not going to get me any kind of heat. I'm going specifically to generate comp play and do my best to fool them about how big my action is, how many hours I'm playing. You know, one of the things that I like to do is on a busy weekend is sit down at a table, buy in, start to play, go to the bathroom, go to a completely other end of the casino to a completely different pit, sit down at a table there, buy in, start to play, go to the bathroom. So now I'm logging twice as many hours because they have me logged in at two tables at the same time.
Uh-huh. And you're spending all this time in the bathroom. That's must be the secret to your success.
Going back and forth between the tables.
All right. Did you learn things from Max in terms of comp hustling?
Oh, absolutely.
Good.
And you know, I think his book was one of the most important books of the last 10 years. I mean, for high-end players, you know, the whole field of comp hustling, you know, it's a whole form of advantage play that
it is.
A lot of people don't really even realize.
It is, and it's mainly for table games, but even as a video poker player, I got a lot of inspiration out of Max's book, and he's a funny guy.
Yeah.
Max is charming. He was on the show before, and it wasn't his best interview. Frank Neal and I, for whatever reason, didn't bring out the best in Max that night, so I'm expecting we're going to do better this time. So
you
we
did get him drunk first, right?
That
was your mistake.
I don't know.
Got to liquor him up.
Well, that could be it, and he might be on the wagon now, so I don't know. But enough about Max for a week. Let's talk about Professor Rose. Professor I. Nelson Rose is a distinguished senior professor at Whittier Law School and visiting professor at the University of Macau. He's an internationally known scholar, author, and public speaker, and is recognized as one of the world's leading experts on gambling law. He has more than 1,500 published works. Professor Rose is best known for his internationally syndicated column and 1986 landmark book called Gambling and the Law. He's co-author of the Internet Gaming Law, Blackjack and the Law, and the first case book on the subject, Gambling Law, Cases Material. Professor Rose is co-editor-in-chief of the Gaming Law Review and Economics. Professor Rose often acts as a consultant and expert witness for players, governments, and the gaming industry. He may be reached via his website, which is www.gamblinginthelaw.com. Professor Rose, welcome to Gambling with an Edge.
Well, thank you, and thank you for the introduction.
I'm glad you're here. Before we start, we probably ought to say that we are taping this 2 weeks before air date. Because of scheduling reasons, Professor Rose cannot participate Thursday evenings. So we're actually taping this on a Thursday afternoon 2 weeks in advance. So it is possible that some of the things we talk about, there will be news between now and then, which are going to make some of our predictions seem pretty silly. But as of now, we're doing the best we can. So,
or show how what geniuses we are.
Oh, well, good. Let's be a genius. So the Department of Justice accused Full Tilt of running a Ponzi scheme rather than running a legitimate online casino. Now, a recent column by you in Poker Player suggested that you didn't think Phil Tilt was guilty at all of that, although they could have been guilty of fraud or stupidity. So tell us about this.
And throw in greed, at least by the insiders who knew that they were that the funds were frozen and they were still taking out tens of millions of dollars. I don't understand, actually, why the Department of Justice decided, with everything else, all the other charges, that they had to throw in Ponzi scheme. Basically, of course, they've got the criminal gambling charges that were filed on Black Friday back on April 15th. There's a civil suit also, and what they did is the Department of Justice recently amended the civil suit to say, hey, some of the insiders, in fact, they're trying to make all the insiders look bad, which isn't really fair, but that they took out tens of millions, hundreds of millions of dollars of players' money, and that's the reason that the players can't get their money back. Well, that is bad, but to call that a Ponzi scheme is really misleading. I mean, a Ponzi scheme is a fake business. There is no business. And I don't think there's any doubt that Full Tilt was a legitimate business. It did run poker games, and the company took money by raking the pot. It's not like they were having no poker games and simply paying people with later players' money. So that's why I wanted to clarify that it wasn't a Ponzi scheme. I'm not saying that what they did was good or legal.
But using the term Ponzi scheme makes for much better headlines.
Yes, particularly in these days of the big financial meltdown that took place under President Bush and all the, you know, the corruption and problems and the fact that, in fact, no banker, nobody on Wall Street has gone to prison for what they were doing. But it's not a Ponzi scheme.
Mr. Madoff kind of went to prison, but...
Well, he went to prison. His was a Ponzi scheme, right? His was a true, real Ponzi scheme. He took money from investors, told them, I'm always going to make money, up market or down, I'm making money, and he would make money for year after year as long as new money came in from later suckers. But he wasn't actually buying and selling any stock. It was a true Ponzi scheme. Here what happened is the insiders, I mean, the numbers are crazy, that if they had stopped being so greedy, if they had only taken out $100 million instead of $400 million, there'd be more than enough to pay all the players back. Now, there's an interesting question on whether it's illegal. Probably the major crime would be fraud. But to show fraud, you've got to show that they actually told players, yes, we've got your money secured, it's in separate accounts, and we're not going to touch it. And that's going to be a little bit difficult, but it looks like they might be able to prove fraud.
Well, I suspect that we'll still have Full Tilt to talk about next time you're on as well.
So, oh, yeah.
Richard, why don't you ask a question about some Indian casinos? You had it.
Yeah, I'd really like to get into questions about Indian casinos. And what rights do we as players have? Are we in the same case? I mean, do we have the same rights in terms of, you know, them dragging you into the back room? And are different tribes different in terms of what the compact is with the state in terms of the rights of the players?
Well, technically, every tribe is different. So it's a very good question. And you would have to check the compact, which you can't get your hands on. So it's very difficult to know what your rights are. In general, the tribes being sovereigns, they're often thought of as dependent or domestic nations, in other words, countries within our country, and therefore they have a lot of right, like the right to do what they want on their own land. Now, they don't have the right to have you arrested. I mean, there was that recent case in Michigan, which I can't figure out. Well, I guess the tribal court convicted him, but that doesn't mean the guys are going to have any problem. But in general, the players' rights depend on the tribe, which means the tribe has its own gambling commission. Often they have their own court. Often you cannot go to state or federal court to protect yourself. So if you feel you've been cheated or been denied a prize, normally you make a complaint to the tribal commission and the tribal court. But, of course, what you're really doing is making a complaint to the tribe itself. And outsiders, in reality, tend to lose those cases. So
if you were to go into a tribal casino and find, say, a shoe that you were sure was missing tens and aces, a short shoe, the only recourse you have would be to complain to the tribe?
No. There are many of the states have what are called public law 280 states, which means that the state has criminal jurisdiction. And that would possibly be a crime, and you could make a criminal complaint to the state, which, of course, undoubtedly would get blown off. I don't think you're going to get much satisfaction, but at least they're theoretically that right. Under the Indian Gaming Regulatory Act, illegal gambling on Indian reservations is a federal crime, so the FBI may have jurisdiction, although you have an interesting question there. It's not really illegal gambling. It's actually fraud. It's actually cheating. So you could go to the feds. Again, you'll probably get blown off. So in many states, there are co-regulators. The state itself has a compact with the tribe, and the state is supposed to be a co-regulator, so you can go and complain to the state. The reality is they might investigate, but even there, like in California, when Gray Davis was the governor, he signed away the rights to sue for money, that you can complain, but there's not a whole lot you can do about it. And by the way, it has actually happened. I got involved in a case in California on behalf of the tribe that was being sued because one of the players said the deck was marked. It was a six-deck shoe. And the tribe said, no, it wasn't, and we'll hire an expert. And I came out with an ultraviolet light and found out, wow, it was marked. I could every single 10 card had lines on it, which showed me, by the way, that the tribe was not involved. It must have been a crooked dealer, because otherwise why would they have an expert come out to look at it? So they showed, yeah, the cards were marked, and then the court said, yeah, but you can't sue a tribe, and they threw the lawsuit out.
Wow.
That tells us a lot about whether it's smart to gamble in California, doesn't it?
Well, there's always a worry when you're dealing with a self-regulated gambling entity. That's the problem with tribes and cruise ships, charity bingo. They tend to be self-regulated. The theory is, or the internet with a lot of times, the theory is, oh, well, an operator would never cheat because their reputation would get hurt. And the reality is, no, how is their reputation going to get hurt? People are going to post bad things about them on the internet. They'll just post good things about themselves on the internet.
Yeah. You mentioned the case in Michigan. So for our listeners, this was a case at the Four Winds Casino in Michigan. And two players were arrested by the tribe. And they were tried in a tribal court and found guilty of cheating for taking advantage of the dealer's hole card.
Yes.
Now, do they have any appeal to any court outside the tribe, or is there just nothing they can do?
Well, in 1978, the United States Supreme Court ruled very firmly, 7-2 decision, very explicit, tribal courts do not have criminal jurisdiction over non-Indians. Unless there's only two possibilities that they had criminal jurisdiction. There could be an express act of Congress giving the tribe criminal jurisdiction, and I don't know of any that have done that. Secondly, they could be Indians. I mean, if they're a member of the tribe, then they would be subject to the tribe's jurisdiction. But if they're just outsiders who happen to be there and are charged with some crime, then no, the court has no jurisdiction. The normal procedure is you file for a writ of habeas corpus in federal court saying, hey, these guys are trying to charge me with a crime, this tribal court, and the court has no power over me, and the federal court says you're right. So, but maybe they've decided the cheaper way to go, rather than hire a lawyer, is to simply ignore it and never go back onto the tribal land.
Okay, so nobody can enforce that judgment or that finding of that tribal court other than the Indians themselves.
Right. It's completely invalid. The tribe, unless there's an act of Congress, the tribe has no power to issue a judgment. It would be just as if, it's Halloween. Imagine I'm walking down the street wearing a robe, acting like a judge, and I decide to arrest somebody and throw them in jail. That's how little power it they had.
They won't send Tonto to come get you, though, huh?
The South Point has more than 10,000 video poker games returning more than 99%. This is more than anybody else. The South Point has free online poker tournaments every day. There are $100,000 in prizes given away each month, and one weekly winner receives a $10,000 seat to next year's main event in the World Series of Poker. There are hundreds of daily events. Some are free. Some cost 100 slot club points with a value of 30 cents, and the highest priced one seemed to be 500 points for worth a full $1.50. Register at southpointpoker.com. Double points in November will be happening on Thanksgiving, midnight to midnight. You will find me playing quick quads. On Tuesdays in November at 8 p.m., there will be a great turkey spin drawing. You can earn tickets every day with a maximum of 250 tickets each day. If you can be there every day, and Tuesdays at 8 p.m., this is a good low roller event where nobody can earn more tickets than you. The prizes are big. You will not have a huge chance because there will be other people in the drawing as well, but nobody will have a better chance. You can pick up a free 14 to 16 pound frozen turkey on one of the 3 days just before Thanksgiving, so long as you played 1,000 points at video poker or 400 points at slots during the week of November 13th to 19th. In the South Point Poker Room, they have a Texas Hold'em Bad Beat Progressive that starts at $25,000. When the progressive is at reset, that is $25,000, you need to lose the hand with four eights to four aces, including a pair in your hand. As the progressive increases, the qualifying hands for the jackpot go down a bit. If it reaches $50,000, for example, aces full of kings will be a satisfactory qualifying hand, although you need a pair in your hand. The Palms. Play, earn, and win prizes on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday between November 14th and 23 have a theme of modern living, including DVD classic movies, scarves, blankets, cookware sets, a Christmas tree, and more. On Tuesdays and Thursdays, you earn 25 points and swipe your card for a gift. Tuesdays, there's a lot of Rebel gas cards given away, and Thursdays is mostly food cards. At the time we're taping this show, they have not announced drawings for the last 2 weeks of the month. I suspect this will change, but right now I have nothing definite to tell you. See the Club Palms for details. Throughout November, you can eat for half price at the 24/7 Cafe if you use your new points. 24/7 is a modestly priced coffee shop, and now the prices are cut in half. Good deal for good eats. The Palm is noted for free megabuck pull every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. Whether you get one or two pulls each time depends on how much you've played. I'll usually pick this up if I'm on the property for something else and the line isn't too long. If the line is long, I skip it. I don't honestly expect to win megabucks, but hey, it could happen. What's going on at the M Resorts depends on what day it is. Monday is Mystery Multiplier Day. Wednesdays, seniors get a free slot tournament and various discounts, and everybody can earn lotto tickets. Fridays, they have hot seat drawings every 2 hours between 2 p.m. and 10 p.m. Many players at the M have received incentive packages. Incentives are based on your average amount of play. If you play more than that, you will get a specific bonus in free play. These incentives have been averaging 0.3 to 0.4%, which sort of makes a double point day into a triple point day, or a triple point day into a fourple point day, so long as you fulfill the required amount of play. If you're not getting these incentives yet, it's because you haven't been playing enough. Every day, you can get up to 3 free buffets at the M for a modest amount of play. This is one of the best buffets at town, and the play requirements make it very inexpensive to get. The M has better gifts more often than most other local casinos. Still to get this month are 2 bottles of wine, a pumpkin pie, and 4 logo shirts of various types. One's a t-shirt, one's a sweatshirt, one's a polo shirt, and one is, I didn't know what the list is, but it's there.
Now, what about, like, in many places, the tribes seem to have a lot of cooperation with local police. So, you know, you're in a casino in a western state, and you get out and you leave, and suddenly there are police, you know, pulling over your car because the tribe called them. I mean, is that legal, or, I mean, do you have any recourse, or is it just like...
Well, you would go immediately to court, again, probably federal court, and ask for the writ of habeas corpus, which is the great writ, the bring the body forth, you know, to set you free. And you might have a suit for, you can't sue a tribe normally. Sometimes you can sue the police or whoever arrested you for a wrongful arrest. I got involved in a case of a very, very big loser who had lost in a tribal court, and they tried to get him and wrote a bad check to the tribe, and they tried to get him arrested the way, you know, bad checks in Nevada can lead to a criminal complaint. And this was, I believe, in Connecticut, and we were able to get it knocked out. Basically by convincing the state, no, you don't have to treat a check to a tribal casino the same as a check to a non-tribal casino.
So I can go to the Barona Casino and write a check for $10,000 off of a phony account and nobody's going to come after me?
Well, first of all, I never said that, and I certainly wouldn't recommend it.
Oh.
But in... I don't think that California doesn't, or no other state has the rules and the procedures that Nevada has when it comes to bad checks. You know, in Nevada, the district attorney gets 10%, so there's a real incentive there for the DA to be very active. And if a casino is owed a lot of money...
Wait, are you kidding? The district attorney gets 10% of recovered bad check stuff?
Not recovered. The amount claimed. Bigger than the
not personally, the office of the district attorney, right?
The office of the district attorney, yeah, was that's it's a really bad incentive there for the district attorney to file criminal charges against somebody merely because they didn't pay a marker when it was due. And,
wow.
And under the Nevada law, they can't. It is in fact a criminal offense. If you didn't have the money in the account when you wrote the marker. I mean, players think markers are just IOUs, debts. The casinos and the district attorney take them as checks. So you get under the bad check law. And the interesting thing is that because it's the state, it's the district attorney, they're not covered by the Fair Collection Practices statute. So they can do things like that other people can't do, such as threaten to put you in jail. But in other states, I haven't found very many other states where, or any other state that I know of, where they turn merely not paying a marker into a criminal case. The danger for players all over the United States is they can extradite. So players have been extradited. You know, California simply gets a notice from Nevada, hey, this guy wrote a bad check, and he's a crook. And they don't realize, no, it's just a marker for a casino. And they may, in fact, extradite somebody from California to Nevada.
Huh. Yeah. Changing subjects. Oh, can we introduce a different subject? Is that all right?
Absolutely.
Suspicious activity reports.
Oh, yeah.
The rules on these seem to be changing.
Yeah. Did you get? I sent you on my website, gamblingandthelaw.com. I'm always posting my columns and papers I've written, and I've presented papers on this. In fact, I'm going to be coming to a conference in 2 weeks from now in Las Vegas on...
Actually, 2 weeks from the tape date, but it's going to be before the thing airs. So
it will be. Yeah, you're right.
So why don't you tell us what you did say 2 weeks from now? Good.
Right. There is it's called the U.S. Online... gaming law conference held at the Aria Resort, and it's going to be on this Thursday and Friday. But I've also put on my website on gamblingandthelaw.com how casinos are becoming much more cooperative with the IRS, mainly because the IRS is pushing them, that there are these cash transaction reports, there's a suspicious activity report, there's all this stuff the casinos have to do. Well, even those take time because you're only supposed to file them at the end of the month. And so the Treasury Department now has asked casino informally, hey, if you see something suspicious, just call us up and tell us. And, you know, when the IRS and Treasury ask you for something, you tend to want to cooperate because you don't want to get audited or get in any trouble.
So the article, you mentioned somebody who would go around to a lot of different accounts and pull out $9,900 to keep underneath the $10,000 minimum. So that would be one thing that was suspicious. What other kinds of suspicious things are casinos now looking for? Plaids with stripes or what?
Yeah. No, you're right. I mean, the what's called structuring... And I like to call it smurfing because that's what people call hire smurf, which are not little blue people, but they're people to go around and cash $9,900 transactions for you. That used to be legal, and they passed a law to say, no, now that's illegal. So it's not just suspicious, it's illegal. But the problem is with the suspicious activity report casino, SARC, with the SARCs, is... it's both a subjective and an objective standard, meaning if the casino employee thinks something's going on, then they have to report it. Or if they should have known, if after the fact somebody says, hey, you should have realized that was suspicious. And the problem is that the Treasury, when they first drew this up, really didn't know the casino business. Obviously, that's not their business. So... they gave us an example of a suspicious transaction, a guy who wins, say, $9,000 on sports bets, gets in a casino, decides to get paid off half in chips and half in cash, and he takes the cash and puts that in his pocket, and the chips he goes and plays craps with. And they decided that was a suspicious activity. And I was at a meeting with a casino managers and Treasury officials, and they said,
would think
we have
that
people
would...
do that every day.
Casinos want them to do that.
Right, because the cash is what he's not going to gamble with, right? And the rest is, I mean, so the funny thing is they actually say things like suspicious activities are if a person shows you two or three identifications and they have different names on them. Well, duh, that would be suspicious. or if it's so comprehensive that they actually had to say, if, in fact, somebody holds you up at gunpoint, it goes to the casino cage and takes $50,000 in cash and runs out.
What's suspicious about that?
You don't have to report it as long as you report it to the police.
Huh. Well, okay. There's a good chance that would be reported to the police, just to guess.
Yeah. Isn't there some requirement that... Isn't there some requirement they have when you cash out $3,000?
There are two completely separate reports. There's the cash transaction report, which is $10,000, and now that's cumulative over 24 hours.
So, right.
Then there's the suspicious activity report, which is normally $3,000 or above. But if you go in with $2,000 and it's all in $1 bills, and they're all kind of dirty, they probably would file that. And the interesting thing is the cash transaction report, you need two forms of identification. This is, and obviously the player knows one is being filed. The suspicious activity report, which is to catch criminals, not just tax evaders or drug, I don't know what, you know, the currency transaction, but the suspicious transaction, it is a crime if the casino tells you that they're filing that. So they may think you're doing something suspicious and file a report on it. And I can tell you, if you get a SARC, you're going to be looked at real good. Get a SARC, get a CTR, get these reports filed with the IRS, you get audited.
Well, I get CTRs all the time. The $10,000 dollar minimum. Whenever I get jackpots, so I get those all the time. But I'm filing as a professional gambler, and so yes, I get audited occasionally. But it isn't like you get one of those and you're automatically audited. Those I'm not personally worried about.
And also, they've changed it finally with the jackpots. Remember the point of all this. The point of the cash transaction reports is we want to see if it's dirty money, if it's drug money. That's what they say. What it really was is we want to see if it's unreported money, like a guy who owns a restaurant and this actually happened. He reported he made $3,500 a year, and he was going to the casinos and gambling well over $10,000 in cash every year, a lot of times a year, because he got paid in cash. And you know, but the point of this is for the IRS to find out about big cash transactions. Somebody finally convinced them, wait a minute, when you have a big jackpot, you already know where the money came from. You know it gets reported because there's tax forms that have to be filed. So you, Treasury, already know about this jackpot. So they finally decided, okay, big slot machine jackpots don't have to file separate cash transaction reports if the player wants to be paid in cash, and that cut the number of reports they had by about two-thirds.
Wow.
All right, we got 3 minutes left.
Wow.
We're going to have, and we got lots more questions. Give us a good 3-minute answer to this one. One of our sponsors, South Point Casino, has created a South PointPoker.com, which they say is a legal place to gamble online.
Yes.
So my question is, what makes this legal and certainly other internet gambling illegal? And presumably they're doing this to work out the kinks so that when it is legal for states to offer internet gambling, they're hot to trot, ready to go. And is this going to happen? And you got now 2.5 minutes to give us a full and complete and annotated answer.
Great. Well, in fact, I went to the site, and I think it's an extremely smart thing to do. I have been advising clients in the gaming industry for years to get up and operating with legal sites, free sites, to get all the bugs out, because players have no loyalty. And if the site crashes, they'll just go to another site once it becomes legal. So get it up, get your name out there, get the bugs out. The reason the SouthPointPoker.com site is legal is it's free. It's not gambling. You can't gamble. There's no you can't make bets. It's simply a free site, which means it's like a no purchase necessary sweepstakes. Having said that, they have a couple things that I thought were interesting. One was they exclude people from Oklahoma, Mississippi, and Quebec. I have no idea why, except that I know, I think it's Oklahoma has an ancient law that says risking money on a game of chance or skill is illegal. But again, you're not risking money, so I don't know why they're bothering with those.
But
three
states. But you are. You, some of them require 150 slot club points or 500 slot club points, which is worth a dollar and a half. It's not a dollar and a half to do it, but it is. You have to have 500 slot club points to play.
But you can play for free as long as
you can play for free, but there are some that are you have to pay this.
No, but they give you the points just for logging on. They give you points.
That's the reason. It's the free alternative means of entry, which is just like a no purchase necessary sweepstakes. That means as long as everybody is treated with, they call it, equal dignity, if your chances are exactly the same whether you paid or you got them completely free, then it's legal. The interesting thing, by the way, is that they allow people from Nevada to do this. In fact, that they operate while being licensed in Nevada, because there happens to be a bad attorney general opinion from about 12 years ago that came to the ridiculous decision that only Nevada casinos cannot offer casino games, and poker is considered a casino game in Nevada, cannot offer casino games for free where you can win valuable prizes by playing the casino games. Only Nevada casinos are not allowed to do that.
So we're going to have to hear more about this one next time you're on.
Yeah.
We're running out of time, but thank you very much. We appreciate your having here. This is your third visit. We hope to have the fourth and fifth down the road.
Absolutely. Anytime. We'll set it up except for Thursday nights.
All right. And your site is gamblingandthelaw.com.
Gamblingandthelaw.com.
And people who want to get in touch with you, there's on that site there are phone numbers and emails and stuff in order to do that.
Absolutely.
Thank you very much.
Thanks a lot.
All right, Munch, we got a couple minutes. What did you learn?
Wow, we learned a lot. I mean, we learned that the case that everybody's been talking about in Michigan basically means nothing. That the tribal courts do not have jurisdiction over non-tribal people. So that was a biggie for me.
Does it make you nervous about gambling in California, or not California specifically, but Indian casinos anywhere?
Slightly, not so much the ones in California, Arizona, New Mexico, but you know, I'm always a little wary, especially when you go into these little places in out in the middle of nowhere in Wisconsin or something like that. I'm always a little leery, but a lot of times you go to the places that are off the beaten path, and sometimes you find a gold mine. So I'm more than willing to take, risks to go find potential great rewards.
Uh-huh. Go look, but you're not looking for hole cards in Michigan.
No, actually, now might be just the time to go do that.
Oh, okay, good. Well, that's good because we have time because we're out of time. So we're going to see you folks next week. Our guest is going to be Max Rubin. So everybody go out and hit lots of royal flushes between now and then.
You've been listening to Gambling with an Edge with your hosts, Bob Dancer and Richard Munchkin. Subscribe to the show in iTunes, and episodes will be delivered to you automatically every week. Archived versions of past shows may be found at bobdancer.com and richardmunchkin.com. We welcome emails at gamblingwithanedge@gmail.com. Bob Dancer and Richard Munchkin are both available on Facebook and welcome your questions. The sponsors for the show are the South Point Hotel, Casino, and Spa, the M Resort, the Palms Casino Resort, and the website videopoker.com. Join us again next week for another Gambling with an Edge.